The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The Senate Majority Leader talks judges.
My motto for the lifetime appointments to the courts is leave no vacancy behind.
We look at the Second Amendment.
Every mass shooting we see happens where, Seb? In a gun-free zone.
President Trump gets a big win on Mexico.
Assuming they actually act in a more aggressive way. And I think the conclusion you would come to is that it was the president's threat.
Yes.
Of tariffs that got them there.
And the Golden State once again looks to increase spending of other people's money.
California's finances. If they were a private business, we'd get the accountant thrown in jail.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. Follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. There are a few things a president can do with long-lasting influence, like the appointment of federal judges. There are three current judges on the Supreme Court who have been there 25 years or longer. Beyond that, there are an untold number of cases that are decided in the circuit and the district courts of the federal system, again, by judges nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate. And while that is traditionally a quick process, it has not been so for President Donald Trump. Democrats are successfully stalling many appointments. They realized the president had a rare opportunity to reshape courts that had been filled with liberals for some time, and so they went into full slowdown mode. I invited Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Hugh Hewitt Show to find out if it's time to be concerned.
So I'm looking at the list of judges, and you have thus far led the Senate in the confirmation of two Supreme Court judges, 41 circuit court judges, and 70 district court judges. Where do we stand, Leader McConnell, and are we going to get every seat filled before this Congress leaves?
Yeah, my motto for the lifetime appointments to the courts is leave no vacancy behind. And as you've reported on previous shows, the Democratic minorities made it challenging. We made a slight adjustment in the rules about 5 weeks ago, and we've been able to double the pace. So we are spending a lot of time on the executive calendar, not only on lifetime appointments, but the president, you know, who actually won the election, has been denied such significant positions as assistant secretaries of the cabinet by slow walking. So we've spent a lot of time on the executive calendar. We're going to continue to do that, get the president's people finally in place after 2.5 years. His term is half over. There will be no judges left behind, so don't worry about any that may be currently still in committee. As soon as they come out, we're going to clear the deck. And I want to make one other point, too, about to compliment the president and the administration on the kinds of people they're sending up. Your listeners might be interested to know that the age of the circuit judges that we are confirming are a little under 4 years younger than the initial age of President Obama's circuit court nominees. So the administration is paying a lot of attention to not only whether they're strict constructionists, which we think is important, but also trying to find people as young as possible. I remember a few weeks ago, we confirmed a 37-year-old woman for the Fourth Circuit and a 39-year-old man for the Sixth Circuit.
There is a couple of vacancies in the Second Circuit. One is open, one is unannounced, and no nominees. And that circuit could flip to a majority Republican appointee circuit. It's a critical circuit. Do you think they're working on this fast enough at the White House?
Yeah. Look, we're not going to. There's not going to be a single circuit court vacancy. Remember, there's a year and a half left in this Congress, and we're not going to leave any circuit court vacancies behind. I wouldn't be alarmed by the fact that we don't have a nominee yet. The pace has been outstanding. In fact, the best in history. The 41 circuit judges that we've done at this point are far and away the most of any administration in American history. So I would not be critical of that. I know we're going to get nominees, and believe me, as soon as they come out of committee, we'll take them up.
All right, let me talk to you a little bit about the district court judges. This is especially pressing in California. There are dozen vacancies in California for whom there is no nominee, because the blue slip still exists, the right of a home state senator to deny a confirmation going forward. There's supposed to be a deal struck between Senator Feinstein and the White House, but some of these district court, I mean, it's not fair to the litigants. You know well, you were a county judge, which is a different job than a lot of people think, but you know how important trial courts are. What's wrong with the Democrats? They got to be able to find just some judges who will do trial work.
Well, the administration does work with the Democrats at the district court level because we still do allow home state senators of either party to block district court nominees. That's been a longstanding tradition of the Senate. Honestly, Hugh, I don't know what may be transpiring between the White House counsel's office and Senator Feinstein and Senator Harris, but my understanding is the way they work the district judges is they do talk to the home state senators, and we have a number of them. District judges on the calendar, meaning they're ready to be taken up at some point here when some of the obstruction stops, that have cleared both what I call blue and purple states, a blue state meaning two Democratic senators, a purple state meaning one Democrat, one Republican. So the Democrats are not completely irrelevant to the process for district court judges. And the next time we have a Democratic president, we won't be either.
Now, talk to me one more question about judges, about the reason why you just don't keep the Senate in session around the clock until the members break. And this used to be a routine deal. This used to be a
law.
No,
it wasn't routine. No, it wasn't routine. And it doesn't really produce anything. We get more. We're going to do, for example, 8 district judges this week, keeping them in all night, but only harden the other side and make it even more difficult. So it sounds like a solution, but it really isn't.
Let's expand on that, because I do get lots of calls from people who say if the leader, and I defend you all the time, I think the best record of judges ever in terms of appointees, but they say just keep them in town, don't let them go home. And you just said that would harden them. Does it matter if they get any harder because they're already doggone hard?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you don't want to completely break the Senate. And if I thought, believe me, I don't think anybody doubts my persistence about judges. I don't rarely get criticized because I'm not doing enough judges. If I thought that would produce more judges, I would do it. We got a year and a half to go in this Congress. Everybody needs to be patient. We're not going to leave any judges behind at the end of this Congress.
All right. Have you heard anything about retirements from the court, the big court, the Supreme Court?
Not a word. It is a story I think you and I have discussed before that's interesting. President Obama was so anxious to have Justice Ginsburg retire that they almost sent out a press release. She got her back up, according to the story I read, and decided she would wait until Hillary Clinton was elected and let her pick the replacement. That didn't work out too well. I think Justice Ginsburg has, shall I say, minimal enthusiasm for President Trump, and I wouldn't anticipate a vacancy. But if we were to get one before the end of this term, as I have reminded everybody repeatedly, the tradition has been if you have a Senate of a different party from the president, those vacancies created in a presidential election year are not filled, and that's what I did in 2016. However, if the Senate is of the same party as the president, we certainly would go forward if there were a vacancy, but I don't anticipate one.
There has been rumbling of late that Texas is drifting left. It would take a lot of blue paint to cover the Lone Star State, but then Texas acts like Texas again. Salem host Sebastian Gorka spoke with Grant Stinchfield of NRA TV.
We have some good news. What is happening in Texas when it comes to the protection of our children? We've got Greg Abbott has finally done what, Grant?
He signed a whole host of bills that'll make sure that your kids are protected here. Making sure that schools have plans in place, evacuation plans, security plans. There's been other bills that give more protections for churches as well to provide security there. And also making sure that schools are doing the right thing when it comes to trying to figure out if someone could turn violent. And you would hope, Seb, that school districts were doing this already, but the sad reality is in America today, they are not. So many schools are not ready for an attack. So many soft targets out there. And I've said this, the chances of a school shooting happening at your kid's school is slim to none, but the chances of it happening again is 100%. So what are you going to do to make sure that you are prepared? And Governor Abbott's helping.
I visited a college recently, and it turns out I was there for a formal event, and one after another, the public safety officers, the college policemen came up to me. They recognized me. They wanted selfies. They brought the captain over. These were all serious dudes. These weren't, you know, rent a mall cop guys. These are former FBI agents, former state troopers, and former local PD guys that work at a college today. And they told me that for reasons of political correctness, Grant, they are not allowed to carry even a sidearm. And they said, what are we going to do if there's an active shooter? They didn't even have tasers or mace.
So think about that. If you're a law enforcement or former law enforcement and then moving into a job like that, you spent your whole career protected and empowered by a firearm on your side. Now you're going to take a job that literally the administration has put you in direct harm's way because you're still going to try to stop the deranged shooter.
Of course.
But you're unarmed, which means the deranged shooter has the upper hand. Why would anyone want to send their kids to an institution like that to subject them to being put in danger that way? And God bless those guys and gals for taking the job to take a job where they're unarmed.
Let me read to you this story. We love A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart, who covers the Second Amendment. One of the things that Greg Abbott did is he managed to get rid of this limit. There was a limit on armed teachers. I'm going to read to you. Greg Abbott signs a bill allowing more armed teachers in Texas schools. They can be armed, okay, but there were limits set so that the schools that participate in the existing program can only designate one armed marshal per 200 students or one per building. Grant Stinchfield, why would you do that? What is the political reason for limiting your capacity to protect children?
There is no reason of why you would do that, except for if you live in a political fantasy world. And so that's even in Texas. Look, if that could be a former law, now Governor Abbott threw that out, thankfully, in right. Texas, think about what's happening in states like California, Connecticut, Maryland, yes. and Illinois. This is ridiculous. You'd want as many good guys and gals with guns as you possibly can have. And yet, every mass shooting we see happens where, Seb? In a gun-free zone.
Right.
Absolutely. And then you see the governor of Virginia. This guy's got his own set of problems, and he wants to expand gun-free zones. Tell me how a liberal, if you're watching and listening to that, doesn't see it straight in the face that this is idiocracy at its worst coming from the liberals.
Wasn't it the Aurora, Colorado shooter who mapped out before the killing, before the mass shooting, all the gun-free zones so he would be sure that he would be safe? Isn't that correct?
Yes, I believe they all do it. So what does a criminal do in nature? They exploit weakness. The weaker you are, the easier it's going to be to exploit you. And certainly, and I say this over and again, it frustrates me because it's so simple. But the criminal is not going to read a sign that says no guns allowed in the movie theater and put his gun back in the glove
compartment. He'll take you back home. He'll take you back home, right?
Yeah.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, President Trump takes down Mexico.
Assuming they actually act in a more aggressive way. And I think the conclusion you would come to is that it was the president's threat of tariffs that got them there.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. President Trump received an extraordinary amount of criticism for threatening Mexico with tariffs over their tendency to look the other way as their citizens cross into the borders of the United States or citizens from Central America transit their country to the U.S. border. Those threats sent stock markets tumbling, led to negative press from the left and the right. But Mexico needs uninterrupted trade more than we do, and they flinched first. They blinked. That good news brought the markets back. But the media, for the most part, remained firmly against the president. I wrote about the Trump victory in the Washington Post. At the same time, reporter Michael Shear covered it in the New York Times. Michael, a friend of the show, joined me on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Is there, in fact, a problem now that the media is rooting against the president, Michael? And second question, do people think the media is rooting against the president?
Right. I mean, look, I read your column. I tend to agree with you. Let's put aside the headline for a minute, because I think you could, you know, you could focus too much on eight words or whatever it is. I think if you read our piece,
yes,
what our piece was analyzing and what our piece was trying to kind of point out was that the deal as presented, and it's very clearly said, you know, that what we were talking about was what the deal that the president had announced, and then we analyzed the ways in which it was or wasn't a kind of a fully, wholly new approach or a new deal. You know, to the extent that people on both sides use our reporting and distort reporting to make their own points or make their own arguments, you know, look, I think we have a responsibility to be accurate, to say exactly what our, you know, we mean, and to not go beyond what our sources are telling us. You know, to the extent that people are using that reporting to make a point that they want to make because they're a partisan on one side or the other, you know, I feel bad for the state of our political discourse, but I'm not sure that indicts journalism as much as it does the kind of nature of our political discussion.
You know what I think it does? I think it increases the need for... There are nonpartisan journalists. You are among them. Maggie Martin is among them. I am a partisan journalist. Rachel Maddow is a partisan journalist. So there are partisans and there are nonpartisans. You're a nonpartisan. I think it increases the pressure on nonpartisans to put up in the top nuts in the first graphs. This graph, for example, you write, Mexico promises, quote, to deploy up to 6,000 National Guard troops, larger than their previous pledge. And the Mexican government agreed to accelerate the migrant protection protocols that could help reduce what Mr. Trump calls catch and release of migrants in the United States by giving the country a greater ability to make asylum seekers wait in Mexico. To me, that's the key paragraph, but it's in paragraph 8 or 9. And therefore, you know, in our age, people don't actually read anything except the headlines, Michael Scheer. It makes me crazy.
Well, I mean, look, I think you can certainly argue, and I'm certainly not going to claim that every one of my articles is perfectly ordered and perfectly written. You can make an argument that should have been moved up higher. I think I put that in specifically for the reasons that you suggest, which
yes,
is to say, you know, which is to say, you know, I mean, in journalism, we call it the to be sure graphs, right? Like, you know, our reporting, my reporting suggested that there was a lot to this agreement that was not new. But I wanted the readers to understand, and, you know, you hope as a reader that they read to paragraph 9. It's not that many paragraphs, but that you I wanted them to understand that what my sources were telling me is that there were some things that could be perceived as new, especially if the Mexican government follows through on these promises. So, you know, yes, the you know, from what I can understand, the pledges that they made on the Remain in Mexico proposal, if it suddenly accelerates and instead of 8,000 people remaining in Mexico, you have 50,000 migrant asylum seekers, that would be a huge change. But that's not the nature of the agreement. It's whether or not the Mexicans follow through on something that they have long said that they would follow through on.
Let's say the agreement reached on Sunday with the Vice President and the Secretary of State and others associated with them was exactly the same agreement that Secretary Nielsen reached with the Interior Secretary months ago. Exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
But that they did follow through with their commitments now, and they had not followed through since March.
Right.
Would that be a significant victory in the Trump administration's negotiations with Mexico, in your view?
What it would represent is a very dramatic shift in the Mexican government's, you know, actions vis-a-vis this administration. And I think if you were analyzing it, you would have to say, why did they shift? If, assuming, you know, we're playing your hypothetical out, assuming they actually act in a more aggressive way. And I think the conclusion you would come to is that it was the president's threat,
yes,
of tariffs that got them there.
I think it's going to become impossible to get news if people can't agree on narrative.
The dilemma with our really divided politics right now is that, not that we argue about the facts, I mean, argue about what the facts mean, but we argue about what the facts are. And that's a problem for our democracy, I think.
With their southern end bordering Mexico, California has witnessed a steady stream of undocumented immigrants flooding into the state for decades. And with a supermajority of Democrats in the California Assembly and state, and a very, quote, progressive, close quote, governor,
The state is now on the verge of offering those in the state without legal permit free health care. Larry Elder explains one of those glaring issues.
California is poised to become the first state in the union to provide health care benefits for illegal aliens. The governor says that they would be limited to illegal aliens aged 19 to 25. That's roughly 100,000 people, and that would add roughly $100 million in costs to California taxpayers each year. Why is California doing this? Well, because California, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, has an, quote, extraordinary budget surplus. In an article dated November 14 of last year, the governor-elect declared California's budget in, quote, remarkably good shape, close quote. Forecast estimates that the state will have a $14.8 billion surplus 2019-2020 fiscal year, and that's on top of a $14.5 billion in rainy day savings. I remember once the California state treasurer, John Lockyer, who's a Democrat, admonished the Democrat state legislature, stop this spending, just stop it.
This is the culture. But I'm sorry, two-thirds of the bills that I see come out of the assembly, if they never saw the light of day, God bless it. And there's too much. It's almost a courtesy that you're expected to move the junk along because I'm working with the groups and we're going to work this out in the next whatever. Mm-hmm. Just stop it. Just stop it.
See, this is a state that does not have a single Republican who holds an office statewide, not one. And Democrats don't just enjoy a majority in the two chambers of the California legislature. They enjoy supermajorities. Therefore, you get quotes like this one from Senator Maria Elena Durazo, who, according to the Associated Press, scoffed at the idea that there was not enough money, noting, quote, the state has a projected $21.5 billion budget surplus. When we have, you know, a good budget, then what's the reason for not addressing it, close quote, Senator Durazo said. California's finances, if they were a private business, would get the accountant thrown in jail. Forbes says this, quote, the truth is there is no revenue surplus had by California state government. In fact, the state's long-run obligations far exceed projected revenue collections to the tune of $1 trillion in unfunded pension liabilities alone. When factoring in the cost of non-pension benefits for state workers, such as health care for retired government employees, the debt facing California taxpayers rises even further.
Coming up,
Phoenix threatens to make them criminals and imprison them.
Christian artists under attack. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Persecution comes in many forms, in many degrees. Taking away a person's livelihood is a devastating form of persecution. And we are seeing that occur increasingly for Christians here in the United States. The Alliance Defending Freedom is on the front lines in this battle. Salem host Seth Liebson and ADF attorney Samuel Green on his program explained the troubling case of Brianna Kosky and Joanna Duca, two artists who were told by the city of Phoenix that they must create art promoting same-sex marriage or face crippling fines and possibly imprisonment. They joined Seth on AM 960, The Patriot.
So, Joanna, tell me a little bit about what brought you to seeking out the help of Alliance Defending Freedom, our friends at ADF.
We reached out to ADF because we were concerned about our rights as artists. As anyone else who's an artist out there knows, art is incredibly personal, and everything that we create is really an extension of who we are. So when we realized that our speech as artists might be stifled, we were concerned about that. So we reached out, and sure enough, our free speech was in jeopardy. And so we filed this case because, you know, the right of artists to create freely and authentically is important to us, and it should be important to everyone. And we wanted to speak out for the artistic community as a whole.
Well, I'm glad you did. And thank you for doing it and standing up for an artistic community that depends on and is amongst the first to try and defend themselves on issues having to do with the First Amendment. So good for you for doing this. Mr. Green, thank you for coming on and taking this case up. One asks, let me start, what is the disposition of the case right now, and why did Brianna and Joanna think that they were going to be running afoul of the dictates of the city of Phoenix?
Joanna and Brianna discovered that Phoenix actually has a criminal law that threatens them with jail time and fines if they politely decline to create artwork expressing messages that violates their core convictions. And in this case, that would be artwork celebrating same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. Joanna and Brianna are Christians, and they believe that God created marriage as a union between one man and one woman. And so that's the only view of marriage that they can celebrate. Yet Phoenix, you know, threatens to make them criminals and imprison them if they decline to create artwork contrary to those beliefs. So they ended up going ahead and filing the lawsuit and are really pushing for the principle that artists must be free to live and work consistent with their beliefs without punishment by the government. And so this case has been going on for a few years now, and it's gone all the way to the Arizona Supreme Court, and we are currently waiting for a decision from the court, one that we hope upholds freedom for Joanna and Brianna and for speakers across the state and country.
And artists, right? I mean, any number of us can remember the fights in the late 80s and early 90s about artists who weren't of the religious faith that Brianna and Joanna share or have, who were demanding that they get the protections of the First Amendment when it came to insulting religion, for goodness sakes. But Mr. Green, that does raise this question. Is this is all under the First Amendment. Is this a religious case or a speech case, or is it a blend?
It's actually both.
Yeah.
So everyone, regardless of their views about same-sex marriage or whether what they want to say is motivated by their religious beliefs or not, should be free to speak the messages they desire to speak and to refrain from speaking those that violate their convictions.
Of course.
And so that's the principle that we're putting forth in this case.
No one should be able to tell someone else what they believe. That's a violation of the highest conscience, according to Thomas Jefferson. And no one should be able to tell someone what they have to say, which is, I mean, I think a long tradition in U.S. Supreme Court and First Amendment history. I would think that this would be a relatively easy case, but for the fact that Brianna and Joanna run afoul with their Christian beliefs of the currents of the time. Mr. Green, as their attorney, I know that there was a famous bakery case that went to the Supreme Court that sounds a little bit related in some respects. I know it also dealt with a different law. I wonder if you could tell us where the similarity and distinctions are.
Sure. So my firm, Alliance Defending Freedom, had the pleasure of representing Jack Phillips, right, a cake designer in Colorado and the owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop. He faced a similar issue that Joanna and Brianna do, where, like these artists, he gladly serves everyone, including those within the LGBT community, but can't use his talents to celebrate events and express messages that violate his convictions. But in that case, the Colorado government was trying to force him to do so. And that case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the court there ended up ruling on a somewhat narrow issue, but made a pretty strong pronouncement that the government cannot be hostile towards people's religious beliefs, and the government officials need to respect people who hold these beliefs about marriage in good faith. And there's people all across the country who hold in good faith that marriage is between a man and a woman, who still love and serve everyone, but simply can't violate their convictions and express messages that violate their beliefs.
For more of that conversation, go to townhallreview.com. While you're there, sign up for our podcast. Get the best in talk radio daily. Coming up, is the weather an indicator of pending climate doom?
We have fewer people dying from tornadoes, fewer people dying from hurricanes, fewer dollars lost to tornadoes and hurricanes over the last decade. Deaths have been down 99% since the 1920s.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, the florist in Washington receives another blow from the Washington State Supreme Court.
She was minding her own business when the government came after her.
We'll look at why her loss is a loss for us all, wherever you are at on the political spectrum.
Everybody has free speech rights, and the government shouldn't force you to advance any message that you disagree with, whichever side of the line you fall on.
Plus, an extended conversation with John Stonestreet on why all of this matters.
Do we belong to the state, or do we belong to God?
And whatever the culture goes, however it goes, wherever it goes, how should we respond?
It may be that we can roll back some of these changes. It may be that we can protect religious freedom. But even if we can't, we've got to stand where we stand.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Depending on the Democrat you're listening to, we have somewhere between 10 and 50 years before the planet becomes uninhabitable. We're doomed. But they've been making dire predictions for nearly 50 years already, and none of those have actually panned out. Dan Proft, filling in for host Dennis Prager, discussed the latest with David Harsanyi, senior editor at The Federalist. He begins with a gem from Senator Chuck Schumer.
As I have said so many times, no threat poses a greater danger to our planet than that of climate change. The last 5 years have been the warmest on record. There's more carbon dioxide in the air than any point in human history. Our children and grandchildren will live with the consequences of the decisions we make today. We need all hands on deck, the federal government, local governments, municipalities, corporate leaders, global efforts, if we are to meet the challenges of climate change head on.
Sure. Tom Steyer's got some cash laying around after he made it all in fossil fuels. And Michael Bloomberg does as well. He's willing to put maybe 1% of his net worth into a new initiative he announced while addressing the class of 2019 at MIT. Beyond Carbon, $500 million to launch this new climate initiative. Michael Bloomberg saying, here are the things that we're going to do. We're going to push states and utilities to phase out every last U.S. coal-fired plant by 2030. Second, we're going to work to stop the construction of new gas plants. Third, we're going to support our most powerful allies in government and politics in pursuit of ambitious policies and laws. And finally, we're going to get deeply involved in elections across the country because climate change is now first and foremost a political problem. The technology's there. There's just the political will that's lacking. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by David Harsanyi. David, thanks for joining us. I wanted to give you the first bite on this NPR report. We all owe Al Gore an apology because of this flooding in the Midwest, and so I wanted to give you the opportunity to first apologize to Al Gore.
I'm going to hold off on that apology for a little bit, but we look at some numbers, and I think all this scaremongering over weather, which isn't climate unless it's useful, is very interesting, especially when you look at the numbers. There's just no tangible evidence. There's no quantifiable evidence that things are getting worse for people as far as extreme weather goes, which is a constant topic recently. We have fewer people dying from tornadoes, fewer people dying from hurricanes, fewer dollars lost to tornadoes and hurricanes over the last decade. Deaths have been down 99% since the 1920s. There's just no evidence that life is getting more hazardous for people because of the weather. And they keep saying this, but there is no evidence. I think we see that people don't actually believe it in the way that they act. They don't act like they think the world's going to end in 12 years because they know it's really not.
Well, right. And in addition to that, I mean, it seems like people that are actually practitioners in the space, they know it, too. They're not paying attention to so much of the political drivel. The International Energy Agency said energy demand, this is them reporting on 2018, energy demand worldwide in 2018 grew by its fastest pace this decade, driven by a robust global economy, with fossil fuels meeting 70% of the growth for the second year running. Because, you know, wind, solar, batteries are expensive, too expensive. And so how is that going to be turned around in, you know, these artificial time horizons that are set by politicians looking to make a name for themselves, whether it's AOC or Michael Bloomberg?
It's not. I mean, you have huge growing economies across the world and more to come. And those people don't want to live in poverty, and they want air conditioning, and they want cars, and they want things that make life better for them. We never really measure what fossil fuels do for us in our, you know, contemporary debates, but it allows us to live lives that are just, even looking back 50 years, just incredible. So all those things are just embedded in our lives. We don't think about it every day. We might talk about, scaremonger about climate change, but we know there's very little we can actually do about this sort of growth. And there just isn't an answer for it. There is no, I mean, it's funny that the Green New Deal eliminated nuclear energy, which actually might help to some extent, or, you know, fracking, which helps, lower carbon emissions as well through gas. But in the big picture, our efficiency might help, but overall it's going to be fossil fuels for the foreseeable future, and there's nothing anyone's going to be able to do about it.
There's a meteorologist named Joe Bastardi had an interesting piece, too, talking about some of the red herrings that are promulgated by the deindustrialization set, the Green New Deal people. The whole, it's settled science, you know, the debate is over. Well, if it is, Bastardi asked, then why is there a continuous flow of money to research it? If it's all done, why is there continuous money to research it? And why has all the modeling of the last 20 years, including from Nobel Prize winner Al Gore, why has it been wrong?
Well, you know, people always ask me, and they probably ask you as well, why you hate science, you know,
why you're
this knuckle-dragging troglodyte who can't look at a chart and just accept it. Well, there are a few reasons I hate science. One of the reasons I hate science is because they're terribly wrong when predicting things all the time. I don't even dismiss that things are getting warmer. I don't even dismiss that man has something to do with it. I just don't think it's the only thing you think about. There are economics, you know, factors we have to include. There are moral factors we have to include. And then we also have to think about how wrong scientists have always been about the future. If we were listening to the Malthusians in 1970, we would have thought that the world would end by 2000, and we would have acted accordingly, which would have destroyed our society in many ways. So I don't hate science, but I do hate people who only think about science, and you know, honestly, they're frauds, and they're pretending that they care about science, and they do sometimes, and sometimes they don't. But there's a lot more to the equation.
I mean, are we in a situation, and maybe this is an argument that needs to be made more repeatedly, rather than getting into the details of interpreting graphs or reminding people what the actual data is, you know, what our record is on the environment versus all those Paris Accord signatories, for example. But Michael Crichton, I mean, 15 years ago, 16 years ago now, the great author, taking on environmentalism, he just talked about it. Look, it's a religion for the left. And so everything is taken on faith. So there's no arguing because the evidence is dismissed because everything I believe about the environment, its fragility, climate change is an article of faith.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it has an apocalypse. It has all the sort of, you know, parts that are, you know, or ideas that are religion and propels religion. And people react accordingly. I definitely think that's part of it. But also, you know, just to go back, you know, about the scientists, I don't know that there probably is a consensus of scientists who agree that there's warming. I highly doubt there's a consensus of scientists who think the world's going to end in 12 years. And, you know, I know people hate when you say this, but Weatherman can predict what's going to happen next week. I just don't trust that anyone can predict what's going to happen 12 years from now.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, Senator Gillibrand of New York has something to say.
I think it's very instructive to hear the condescending derision that people like her have for us, for most of us.
Mike Gallagher with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Democratic presidential candidate and senator from New York, Kirsten Gillibrand, recently compared pro-life beliefs to, wait for it, racism. She was in Iowa at the time, where she's hoping to gain some momentum before the caucus in the state, which takes place in February of next year. She's at 1% or less in most polls. If nothing else, she got herself some attention. With such an enormously crowded field of Democrats, attention is hard to come by, and so some Democrats will say just about anything. Here's my colleague, Mike Gallagher.
None of these Democrats seem serious. I mean, do you take this seriously? Did you hear Kirsten Gillibrand? She has to know that more than half the country respects the sanctity of life in the mother's womb. She has to know that. And yet, listen to her pandering in Iowa, along with the rest of them, telling the Des Moines Register that if you're pro-life, you're a racist.
I think there's some issues that have such moral clarity that we have as a society decided that the other side is not acceptable. Imagine saying that it's okay to appoint a judge who's racist or anti-Semitic or homophobic. Asking someone to appoint someone who takes away basic human rights of any group of people in America I think that we are, I don't think those are political issues anymore. And we believe in this country in the separation of church and state. And I respect the rights of every American to hold their religious beliefs true to themselves. But our country and our Constitution has always demanded that we have a separation of church and state. And all these efforts by President Trump and other ultra-radical conservative judges and justices to impose their faith on Americans is contrary to our Constitution, and that's what this is. And so I believe that for all of these issues, they are not issues that there is a fair other side. There is no moral equivalency when you come to racism. And I do not believe there's a moral equivalency when it comes to changing laws that deny women reproductive freedom.
Wow. That's one of the Democrat candidates for president. She thinks it's ultra radical for anyone to push back against third trimester abortions or even legislation that would protect babies born alive after a botched abortion. She thinks legislating against that is ultra radical. Now, this is not a serious person. There's no way. I'm sorry. Although I think it's very instructive to hear the condescending derision that people like her have for us, for most of us, and I dare say most of the country. Hey, physician, heal thyself. You're the radical, Kirsten Gillibrand.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on our earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posey, and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and on the beach somewhere, I presume, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.